So I expect you have it explained each time you on a Tuesday, but we're having a whole year on three jewels, and we did quite a lot on the Buddha, and we're going to do quite a lot about the Sangha, and at the moment we're going to talk about the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha. So this is what this talk this evening is going to be about. It's going to be about a teaching known as the spiral path, or it's also known as the 12 positive nidanas. But I like the spiral path, and I've drawn a picture of a spiral. Here it is, in case you can't tell. I thought of making a model, but I didn't have enough time. That would have been good. It would have been good. Maybe one of these days. So, the talk this evening I called The Spiral Path, The Great Escape. And the reason why I called it that is because I remember there being a film about it. It was a kind of a war film, which I'll talk about a little bit more later on. But also, this path is a way of escaping from samsara, a very clear way of describing the movement from mundane existence to enlightenment. And so what we escape from in the Great Escape is that we escape from suffering. We all know that this world is quite a difficult world to live in. And the Buddha was very specific about what his teaching was about. He said, I teach suffering and the cessation of suffering. I teach that the world is not an easy place to live in, and I teach a way of moving from that world to another kind of existence which does not contain suffering. We all know what suffering or unsatisfactoriness feels like. It's a universal experience. And yet all our experience is not all suffering. Okay, so we do not suffer all the time. There's also happiness and contentment and joy and thrill and dancing and all those sort of things. What I want to talk about today is actually a spiral path which talks about spiritual development in very positive ways. It talks about happiness, delight, joy, I just love it. I just love it. I have a very strong personal response to this teaching. It's a movement. We're not only moving away from suffering, but we're moving towards these extraordinary, lovely mental states. And there can be the form of the Buddha's teaching that comes down to us most strongly in the Theravadin Pali Canon. They just happen to be the people who wrote the teachings of the Buddha, and they survived, because lots of stuff has happened in the last 2,500 years, can be read as a lot of don't do this, don't do that, restraint, cessation, snuffing out. It's all very kind of stop it. this is less stop it and more go for it, which I really like. So this has a very different flavour in this teaching, and it's a formulation of the spiritual path which talks about more and more refined and pleasurable states of mind. And I'm just going to quote Sangharakshita, who's the founder of the Theravada Buddhist movement, about enjoyment. So Sangharakshita said, the main point is that enjoyment is not a luxury, something peripheral to the main business of practicing the Dharma. It is not an element to introduce if there is time. It is central to the whole business. Only joy will keep us going on the spiritual life. If you can only practice the Dharma if you have the energy, the spark, the zest for it. You need to be able to relish it for what it is, a feast for famished heart and mind. I feel like I don't have to say any more. So this teaching comes from the Pali Canon, and I'm not very good at pronouncing things, but it's the Upanisha Sutra.
Maybe.
And it's translated into the Discourse on Supporting Conditions. Sounds a bit boring, doesn't it? But it isn't. And the reason why they're supporting conditions is because each stage of the path supports the one that comes next. Okay? And each stage is dependent on the one preceding it, yet it is not fixed and rigid. The stages grow out of each other as a plant grows, with a constant upward movement. So we start here. I actually found it very difficult to work up a page. Such is the conditioning that I've been, you know, since I've been a little girl, I was taught to write down. So writing that has been quite hard, I discovered. So it has this constant upward movement. And I'm not going to talk about the entire path because there would just be too much of it. There are 12 stages in the path. So I'm going to talk about the most important and exciting bits, how we get started, how that leads to radical change, and a bit about where it can take us. So, I'm going to do the Pedalia thing. So, Sankaracharya says there are two very important teachers that he has re-emphasised and brought into the world. One is the centrality of going for refuge, and the second one is this, the spiral path. This is what I'm talking about today. So this is a very significant and central teaching to Triratna Buddhism. So it starts here, okay? We start at the bottom, where it says suffering, and the word for it is, traditional word for it is dukkha. We are told that the very first teachings that the Buddha gave to his disciples after his enlightenment, which was beautifully called turning the wheel of the Dharma, was about the Four Noble Truths, and the very first of these is the truth of suffering. So what does this mean? The truth of suffering, it's this just the sort of statement that makes people think that Buddhism is all doom and gloom. So I wrote part of this talk when I was on retreat at Taraloka, which is a women's retreat centre, last week. And I remembered that many years ago I asked Sadhanandi, the woman who's the chair there, what kind of women went to the retreat centre. And she told me there were two kinds. She said one kind of women who came to the retreat centre who were women who had had pretty difficult lives, had experienced physical or emotional distress of various kinds. So they were people who had experience of life of being quite hard. And the other group of women who came to Taraloka were women who had done very well in our post-industrial society. They had the job, they had the man, they had the car, they had the house, they had the holidays. And for them, it was a question of, and? It just wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough. Having it all was not enough, and they saw their lives as empty. So although these two groups of women looked quite different from the outside, they had in fact the same problem. They were experiencing dukkha. They were experiencing dissatisfaction. They had a degree of suffering in their lives. So one lot didn't have what they wanted, and the other had what they wanted, but it wasn't enough. And of course I was there for my own reasons. And I was there because I belonged at that moment to the first lot of women. I had two very small children, and I had a partner who'd been diagnosed with cancer. And I was just not managing very well. It wasn't a manageable situation, actually. But was there the obvious emotional stress of having someone so ill who is very close to you, But I also had another layer of upset, which was it was not what I wanted. It was not what I wanted, and it was not what I had bought into. So I'd gone to live in Wales to start my family with a nice man in a cottage, which was almost built, in a field. And what I thought I was going to get was cottage in the country, roses round the door, and happy families. And that's not what was happening. Not what was happening at all. So not only was my sort of obvious situation quite difficult, but also I brought to it another degree of unsatisfactoriness, which was, this is not what I wanted. This is not what I wanted. This wasn't in the bargain, as far as I was concerned. So I had what I didn't want, and I didn't have what I did want. So here I was, down here, very clearly. And the usual response to suffering, when something bad happens to us, is that we is described in the Buddhist tradition as craving. We not only reach out for something pleasurable that will take away our experience of suffering, but we push away everything that we don't like. We don't want to think about it. We want to forget that that's going on. And even when we get something we like, we don't have enough of it, or it comes to an end, and we suffer that lack again. So everything, the Buddha taught that everything actually that is conditioned, that belongs to this kind of way of life, has its disappointments and limitations. We usually go from pleasure to pain and back again as we crave, grasp for something that we want to take the craving away, the suffering away, and then we're disappointed again. So this Buddhist word here, dukkha, is translated as unsatisfactoriness or suffering. It literally means an ill-fitting chariot wheel. And we can all imagine what that's like if you're in the chariot, okay? It's something that doesn't work very well, and it jolts us. It jolts us all the time. We can't get comfortable. You know, we're just not in a good state. It's not a pleasant place to be. Fortunately, in my favour, I had not only the suffering, but I also was aware of my suffering. And that was really important. So I knew that I wasn't doing very well, and I wanted to do better. And I looked around for a way of managing something that was not going to go away. I knew it wasn't going to go away. So I thought, well, how can I just do this differently? So I had an elderly man friend who was a very nice bloke to talk to. He was just very open and just gently encouraging to me whatever I was like. And so I took my awareness of my suffering to him, and I talked to him about it. And I explained to him that I was just really, really upset, and I wanted to run away and have another life, and I wanted to stay and see it through too. And that tension was just kind of pulling me apart. And I felt a bit like a caged animal. I felt my back was right up against the wall, and I had no room for manoeuvre. I felt really trapped by my circumstances. And he looked at me a bit, and he was a bit like Yoda in Star Wars, and he was very small. I just loved him a bit, actually. So he looked at me for a while, and he went, "You could learn to meditate, and I think that that would give you some space." And I thought, why not? Why not? So I didn't know anyone who meditated. My friend Leslie didn't meditate. And so I couldn't go to anybody because I didn't know anyone. So next best thing, buy a book. So I bought a book and I read it. I didn't really understand it because it was about meditation and it's difficult to understand. But it had instructions in it for mindfulness to breathing and metta-bhavana. So I started meditating. And I just had enough momentum in my desire to do things differently to deal with what I was feeling differently, to get me going. I just had that momentum. Somehow I had that momentum to get it going. So in fact, I'd actually started my first stage of my spiritual life. I didn't know that. I didn't want it. But that's what had happened. And it was just a quest for another way of being. It was being able to see that my life, as I ordinarily experience it, is just not enough. It wasn't enough. I didn't have enough to help me deal with that situation. And that was a huge advantage I had. That was a huge advantage, that dissatisfaction. Sangharakshita says that we should respect and take good notice of our dissatisfaction. It would lead us to searching and discovery, but it might take a bit of a while. So we're aware that our life is not as satisfying as we would like and can't be sorted out by the usual attempts at a quick fix. Two beers and a cigarette. Okay. Didn't make it any better. Yeah, it just didn't make it any better. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I went to Leslie and I said, what else can I do? What else can I do? There must be another way. So although it is confused and inarticulate, it may be confused and inarticulate at first, and we don't really know what we're looking for, we start looking around for something else. And if we look long enough, we'll get a glimpse of something higher, something that's a bit different from the way that we do things, and perhaps another kind of truth or reality. In my case, I had never met anyone who was meditated, but somehow it made sense. It just made sense to me, and I responded very intuitively. It sounded like it could work, and I decided to give it a go. It was a bit of an experiment, and it was also a bit of a strange experiment, because for the first year or so, I just felt even worse. Because in bringing attention to how I was, I realised just how difficult my life was. You know, I'd stopped covering it up. So it, you know, it wasn't like a magic wand or anything like that. The good thing was that although it was difficult and upsetting, there was nothing else to do. And somehow I sensed that it would work and would help me somehow long term. So I'd actually gone of a bit of a shuffle down this bit here. Now I didn't know it was faith. I didn't know it was faith at all, but there was something in that word meditating and the book that I got, which was quite a long time ago, and there weren't very many good books around, but I actually got a very good one, which was luck. No, luck's not Buddhist. Good fortune. So I kind of shuffled off down here a bit, and towards faith, the second stage of the spiral path. The Buddhist word for faith is shraddha, as faith is a bit of a bad translation, because when we think of faith, we often think of blind faith, somebody telling you what to believe, and it's certainly not that. It can be, it more literally means lifted up, which I think is lovely, or it can be translated as placing the heart upon. So it's something you have a bit of trust in, although you might not know why. And faith is absolutely crucial. Absolutely crucial. This bit of intuition, this finding something that makes sense, this doing something that works for you, is really, really important, because you can't do any of the rest without it. It's a kind of a first insight. You know, we just have a feel for something of a bit of a different order, and it comes into our lives. And the other thing I wanted to say is that for Buddhists, faith also means coming across the Dharma in some respect. Now, the book on meditation that I bought was written by a Buddhist. It wasn't an overtly Buddhist book. He talks about God in it. Not that I was a Christian, I wasn't. It did have that flavour. It had the flavour of the Dharma. And without the flavour of the Dharma, this faith would not be Shraddha. It would not be Shraddha. So for me, this was beginning of a pretty long journey. And I had another bit of luck. So after I'd been meditating for 2 years, I lived in this really small community in Wales. It had its own little library. And one day I went to the library and there was one leaflet for Tara Loka, the Women's Buddhist Retreat Centre, and it had opened 6 months previously. And I looked at this leaflet and I thought, aha, someone I can ask important questions like, what do you do with an itch? That was one of my major difficulties. I'd have an itch and I'd scratch it and then it would just go somewhere else. So, you know, I just thought this was a important... I had to go and talk to somebody. I realised I had to go and talk to somebody. So I went off to my very first weekend at Tara Loka as my birthday present, the money and a weekend's pass from the children. So, and I was terrified. I was doing this weird thing. And I shook most of the weekend. But it was really good. And... And so I went to the Tara Loka over the next couple of years, probably about 3 times. And then I had a job which meant that I worked weekends and I couldn't go. So I didn't go for another year and a half. But I kept meditating. I just kept meditating. It was kind of what I could do on my own, by myself, for myself. And it was very important to me. And then I found some local classes, local meaning an hour's drive away across the hills. But that was good enough. And I was very, very lucky because I went to some classes in Llangollen, which were run by the men's meditation retreat centre at Vajraloka. And I just stepped in to some of the best meditation teaching that our movement had to offer at the time. And I was away. That's all I wanted. I wanted someone to teach me how to meditate and support my practice. But of course I wasn't Buddhist. I didn't do that. Teach me how to meditate and leave all that weird stuff alone. I'm not interested. So I didn't see myself. So we were talking, I'd probably been meditating for about 5 years by then. And I wasn't a Buddhist. I was a meditator. That's what I was interested in. But I could see it was making a difference. I could tell it was making a difference. And then I had a bit of a moment. And in fact, I was converted to Buddhism by the Labour Party. Believe it or not, this is exactly what happened. So we're talking about Mrs. Thatcher now. And I was always a bit of an activist as a young woman in various ways, but I refused to join any political party because I didn't want to be tied down to anything. And Mrs. Thatcher just drove me into the arms of the Labour Party. And not only did she drive me into the arms of the Labour Party, but myself and a friend of mine actually started a branch of the Labour Party where we lived, where there hadn't been one before, which became really successful, and I became the chair. So I'm now the chair of the Labour Party in Llanrider, in Mocknant. And so I'm in a very seedy pub in Wrexham, in Actravere, which is an ex-mining village just outside Wrexham. And we are mandating our representatives for the party conference. Ever so exciting. I'm in this meeting and it's just like, we're trying to get people to decide how this is not branch, it's area reps will vote at the party conference. And it's very heated. And then suddenly it sort of switches from being heated debate into personal recrimination. And I can't do it. I just can't do this anymore. And I just walked out of that meeting and I resigned from the Labour Party. And I was not a favourite person actually, with quite a lot of people, but they came round in the end. But I just thought, I'm not buying into this. This is what my meditation did for me. It changed the way I looked at things, so I'm just thinking, I am not buying into this polarisation, this building up of hatred, people being unkind to each other. I'm out of here. I'm just out of here. I'm not doing this anymore. So this is a kind of point of conversion. This is where my faith in Buddhism took over from my faith in the Labour Party. And it was very clear. You know, it was sudden and it was clear for me. Not everybody has this kind of experience, but it was for me. Sometimes I think I'm the sort of person that has to get into a bit of a crisis before I'm kind of motivated into another stage. So this is the point of conversion, a point of conversion, the turning away from ordinary things in life to give us satisfaction, to faith in the Buddhist path, faith in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And it's an emotional, intuitive, even a mystical response to our lives. We don't really know what it means. We hit this and we really don't know what it means. But it's also very real. We haven't made it up. It's very real. And it's about a desire to live a life that has meaning and significance, which is often outside the kind of cultural expectations of the society that we live in. Sangharakshita describes this as a moment of conversion, when we've entered the spiral path for real. And if we stay on course, it will lead us to enlightenment. So I'm now going to talk about this bit, okay? So faith to joy. Calm, bliss. Okay, I'm going to do the next four stages. So, from here to here, faith is the motivator that takes us through these stages of the spiral path. It's the driver, actually, of our spiritual life. So it's really important. It's really important. It's the motivating force for the whole of the lower part of the spiral path. It's very important that we recognise our faith, that we nurture it and sustain it and allow it to grow and deepen. We need to give our faith attention and care. But that's all another talk. That's all another talk. But it is really very important. So independence. Faith arises independently. This is the traditional way of saying it. Okay, faith rises in dependence on suffering, and the next stages of the path rise in dependence on faith. Okay, independence on faith, we can live out the Buddhist path more fully. So when we get here, we go, oh, I think I'm a Buddhist. You know, when I lingered here for about 6 years or so before that happened. Perhaps a bit longer. But once we decide on that, then we start to say, well, what is it? What does that mean? So, you know, the next thing I came across was ethics. It was kind of around here somewhere, but it became a bit more important. So we begin to practice ethics. We see the point in our meditation more fully. We may study and learn in more detail the Buddhist teachings. We come across devotional practice, for me, to start off with anyway, although I got to learn to like it quite quickly. And all of this strengthens our emotional resolve, because that's what we need. We need a lot of resolve, and our resolve will come from the way we feel about what we're doing. So the next stage, four stages of the path, are mental states that arise out of meditation. And each is supported by the one previously. So these are known as the meditative absorptions. Okay, and it's mainly talking about what happens in meditation, although it does sort of seep in to the rest of your life. Okay, so faith, when it's supported by ethical practice, leads to a clear conscience, nothing to regret. being able to learn from your mistakes, forgiving both yourself and other people for making mistakes. The three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, are beginning to shape our lives. And joy arises from the knowledge that we're living in accordance with our highest aspirations, or we're doing our best to do that. We are enacting our faith, and that is really important, that we put our faith into action in our lives, because if we don't do that, everything just remains as a good idea. And it just stays as a good idea. And it will continue to be a good idea, but it won't come to any fruition unless we act on it. And independence on joy. And rapture is a very strong experience that we might have in meditation. Some people don't experience it at all. Some very good, strong, effective meditators never experience it at all. And some people fall into it the first time they sit on a cushion. And it's a very physical kind of feeling that you have in meditation. So traditionally it's described as anything from the hairs on the back of your neck standing up, so you get a bit like shivery or pimply, goose pimply or something like that, to levitation. You know, you can feel rapture so strongly that you're swept up into the air. That's not happened to me. But it is, it's a very, very pleasing, strong physical sensation. And there are meant to be 5 degrees of this. And I think the sort of classic quote is, better than sex. and it's just like sex or anything that pleasurable. It can be accompanied with strong craving, which will not do you any good. Okay, so it can be as destructive as a strong sex drive, because you don't want to go any further. You just want to stay there and have fun. But the business is that what is happening here is you are becoming more and more strongly integrated. And as your energies become integrated, it will fade away. It will fade away. And what comes next is even better. It's calm. So it has a tranquility aspect to it, which is not found in rapture. It is still characterized by feelings of intense pleasure. It's deeply satisfying mentally. Thinking becomes much more subtle. So the kind of chatter that we have in our minds a lot of the time just kind of gives up. It goes, what's the point? I'm not going to do that. And that is lovely. You'll still have some kind of thought, but it won't be that kind of incessant chattering. So mentally thinking is much more subtle and non-discursive. And independence on calm, we have bliss. And this is apparently even nicer. So these aren't necessarily things you're going to be able to decide which one you're in, okay? Because they come as a kind of clump. And it's just increasingly refining your mental states. And so, you know, you're not going to be able to say, oh, I tipped over a bit from calm into bliss. You know, it's not really going to be like that, because it's all kind of one movement, really. So bliss is described as balancing and fine-tuning of effort. Again, characterized by intense happiness and this dissolution of thought. So these stages of the path, we just become increasingly integrated. Whatever we do, we have more and more energy behind. Our ethical practice has more energy behind it. Our meditation on a good day has more energy behind it. And we just become more and more who we'd like to be. Our good idea of practicing the Dharma comes more and more into our lives. And this is very important. These stages are a very important part of the spiritual path, because we tame our consciousness and come to grips with our distractions and habits. And it's very important that we do that, because it's a process of progressively letting go of our tightly held ways of seeing the world. Okay. So we're going into the heart of your meditation experience more and more until distraction and mental complexity fade away. So in these mental states we have increasing simplicity of mind, and there's less and less going on, greater openness, less and less interest in the pulls and dramas of all the time. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Yeah? Sounds good to me. So out of these increasingly refined mental states, we have concentration or samadhi. Concentration is a rubbish translation. It really is a very weak and kind of just useless, actually. But I've never come across it described as anything else, really. So it's just not good enough. And the concentration, as we know it, is a complete understatement of what this stage is about. So the previous delightful mental states of the past that will lead to a freer mind, which is flexible and concentrated. Your mind becomes very malleable, you can move from one thing to another. But this stage is even more than that. When we enter samadhi, we can do so from any situation. Our meditation is so thoroughly interwoven into our being that we can meditate through, have that kind of mental state, whatever is happening around us. And I've had one taste of this. I have talked about it here before, when I missed my bus and decided that I had an hour and a half to wait in Bilbao bus station, and decided the best thing to do would be to meditate. And Bilbao bus station was the best place in the world. There was pneumatic drills going on, building sites. I had to keep my eyes open so nobody stole my luggage. The woman next to me started smoking. I'm an ex-smoker. I went, oh, no, she's not going to smoke, is she? And then after that, I went, that was quite nice. And I could just watch my mind just go craving for this, craving for that. How dare they do this? What are they up to? You know, the whole business. And then I just became very concentrated, and none of that mattered. It just didn't matter at all, and I could become very concentrated. I just think, if I could become concentrated in Bilbao bus station, I'm doing well. So this is a deep concentration in a very natural and spontaneous way, this samadhi. And our whole life becomes a preparation for this form of meditation. And at this stage, we have access to wisdom, which is a bit of a mysterious thing to say. And what we're doing is we're learning to exist and experience from a very deeper, much deeper level of being. And so there's a story in the Buddhist scriptures, and it's an integrated flow of pure happiness. Okay? So there's a king, it's always the same, the king goes and sees the Buddha, and the king wants to ask the Buddha something. In this case, this king was determined that he could be happier than the Buddha. So the Buddha was sitting with his monks in the forest, who didn't own anything, he didn't have a roof over his head, he didn't know where his next meal was coming from, and he was just sitting on the ground. And the Buddha went, and the king, with his entourage and elephants and dancing girls and everything like that, he said, well, of course, I must be much happier than you are. And the Buddha just talks to him, and he said, I can sit here for an hour and be quite happy. And the king said, well, I can do that. And the Buddha said, well, I can probably sit here, I can sit here for 6 hours and be happy with that. And the king went, yep, I don't think I could do that. And then Buddha said, but I can do it for a whole day and night. And the king went, probably not. And the Buddha said, I can sit here for 7 days and nights in complete and perfect happiness. Doesn't need anything. Doesn't need anything. And the king thought he probably wouldn't be able to do that. And the Buddha was indeed happier than he was. And Sangharakshita says, a happy mind is a concentrated mind, and a concentrated mind is a happy mind. So here we have, from this point, we have access to wisdom and another kind of understanding of the fundamental teaching of the Buddha. So in dependence on concentration, we have this strange stage which is known as knowledge and vision of things as they are. And it's also known as stream entry. So up until now, the main force behind the movement upwards through the spiral path has been faith. And at this stage, a huge change in consciousness takes place. And from now onwards, wisdom, the direct knowledge of the truth of the Buddha's teaching, takes over as the motivation force, as the driver on the spiral path. And it's just formulated in lots of different ways, because all the Buddha was trying to do was trying to get people to understand what he was trying to tell them, because this is seeing our existence in a way that none of us have ever seen it before. It is something completely different than anything we know about. And my favourite description of this stage of the path is from a different school of Buddhism, and it's called, let's call it, the turning around in the deepest seat of consciousness. And it brings me out my goose pimples. It's just that phrase does something for me. It tells me that there's something really new going on here. This stage is known as knowledge and vision of things as they are, and although it sounds strange, this is exactly what it is. It is about knowledge and vision as of things as they are. We see the world as it is. We penetrate the truths of conditioned existence with our whole being. It's not a mental response. It's an embodied experience. It's like we know something with every single cell in our body. It's completely different from anything that we know about. And this stage is also known as stream entry. We have entered the stream of the Dharma. We are under the sway of enlightenment, and life will never be the same again. I'm just going to give you, Sangharakshita's got a fantastic description of him trying to describe what this might be like. What this might be like. So Sangharakshita says, imagine a day of unfettered inspiration and free-flowing energy. A day in which you were able to be completely true and clear in your communication. A day in which you felt so real a connection with your others that your own concerns ceased to loom so balefully in your life. A day in which you never felt you were hitting your head against a brick wall or getting stuck in a rut. Imagine such a day of creative freedom, and then imagine that freedom doubled or trebled and continuing to expand, and you will start to get the idea of the nature of enlightenment. So the most important quality at this stage of this path is that you cannot fall back. Up to here, you can just slither down again. Such it's like snakes and ladders. You just slither down the path again. And but with having reached this stage, that is no longer possible. It's no longer possible. Enlightenment is assured. So this is the real conversion to the Dharma. This is the real conversion. This is where there is no going back. From this stage onwards, ordinary life as we know it is just a mirage or a child's game. It's something that goes on around us, that we take part in, but we have such a different perspective, we're not caught up in the drama of it, we can play. And that's what they say about bodhisattvas, that they just play, that nothing is like hard work or difficulty. Helping others consistently through many lifetimes is play. And that's the sort of feel that that teaching is trying to give us. We're not caught up in the drama of ordinary existence. We just let go. And I'm just going to stop there because the next stages we don't need to know about. We just need to know this bit. When we get to this stage, we'll know what the rest is like. So, my father died in November, and I thought, after a while, I thought, oh, what I really need to do is I need to go on a retreat. I need to go on a quiet retreat. And I need to do it in supportive, because I expect it's a universal experience, but I was quite rocked by my father's death. And I needed to go away in supportive conditions, and I thought, I'll go to Tarraloma. I've been there for many years. It feels like my other home, and they cook my dinners. So that's how that felt, like, very supportive to me. So so I went on retreat there for 10 days. And I just didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I just didn't know what was going to happen. And I was a bit of me was a bit scared in case, you know, I got very distressed, or I just had no idea what was going to happen. And it was just very strange. It was just very strange, because what happened on that retreat is I just contacted enormous amounts of faith. I just was in touch with why I do this at a very kind of big level. And I experienced very concentrated and flexible states of mind. So, you know, somebody would be leading the activities in the shrine and they'd do this, and my mind would just go and do it. And then the next session they'd say, do the other, and it would go and do that. And I thought, it's fantastic, you know. I'm experiencing this real flexibility of mind. And when I got home, I rang my mum to see if she was all right. And she asked how I was, and I was a bit surprised, because I said to her, actually, Mum, I am really very happy. I'm very happy. And she went, I'm very pleased to hear that. And then a couple of days later, I was talking to a friend in the order about my, you know, going on retreat. And they said, oh, yes, okay. She said, so our independence on suffering arises faith. Independence on faith arises joy. And then meditative absorptions, leading to flexibility of mind and concentration. And I thought, I've read that somewhere. But I hadn't actually put it together. I hadn't put it together, but that is just really what had happened. So my experience of the spiritual path is that I need a strong sense of what I need to leave behind, and a strong sense of something delightful and beautiful to draw me on. And this teaching does it for me. I know it to be true, and I can experience it again and again more strongly. It's not done once and for all. Sangharakshita says it's possible to reach the stage of stream entry. Yeah. In this lifetime, with commitment and dedication to Dharma practice. And I believe that to be completely true, and not only that, but I'm also up for the challenge. And this is the reason why I call this talk The Great Escape, is that there's this very old war movie of this name. And the men in it, I think they escaped from a castle or something in the Second World War. And they're all terribly British. And the film depicts these men as men of vision. They have a plan. They're very determined. They cooperate. They work hard. They show heroism in the face of overwhelming odds. And after their escape, there is release, joy, a new way of life, and no going back. And these are the qualities we will need in this endeavour, and just some of the rewards.